Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture entitled, When Humans Are More Beastly Than the Beasts, Zoomorphism in Ancient India. This lecture is part of a series of lectures looking at the topic of evil, presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Speaking tonight will be Professor Wendy Doniger. Professor Doniger is a Phi Beta Kappa Society visiting scholar, director of the Martin Marty Center, and Mircea Eliade Distinguished Service Professor of the History of Religions, University of Chicago. We begin with an introduction by Susan Jackson, Associate Professor of French and Senior Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University.
It's my pleasure on behalf of the College of Arts and Sciences and the Epsilon of Massachusetts chapter of Phi Beta Kappa, sheltered here at Boston University, as we like to say in Phi Beta Kappa parlance, to welcome you to this afternoon's special event in the Institute for Philosophy and Religion's series on evil, the Phi Beta Kappa visiting lecture by Professor Wendy Doniger. So a word about Phi Beta Kappa and about Professor Doniger. As you may know, Phi Beta Kappa, a formerly secret honor society, has been since its founding in 1776 one of this country's leading forces, not for evil, but for the good, of fostering and recognizing undergraduate excellence in liberal arts and sciences. Each year, Epsilon of Massachusetts joins Phi Beta Kappa chapters across the country in the centerpiece activity of initiating to membership, by way of the still secret handshake, those senior students whose academic achievement has placed them at the very top of their cohort and of whom much is expected in later life. You may be interested to know that our current often divided Supreme Court has a clear 2-to-1 majority of members of Phi Beta Kappa. Meanwhile, at the national level, Phi Beta Kappa each year, as David has said, assembles a roster of distinguished faculty scholars who have generously agreed to make themselves available throughout the year to lecture at other local chapters. As the Epsilon of Massachusetts secretary, I always look forward to receiving the list of Phi Beta Kappa scholars, which tends to read like a who's who of American higher education. What a great opportunity. And yet this opportunity to host a Phi Beta Kappa lecture here often slips by before we know it or have done anything about it, and we find ourselves once again rationalizing that Epsilon of Massachusetts has less need for Phi Beta Kappa lecturers than chapters in the boondocks more starved than we for intellectual stimulation. Two people then deserve special thanks. Professor Eckel for taking the initiative to make a Phi Beta Kappa lecture happen here, and Professor Doniger, because whatever else may be filling our plates, Boston University's appetite for her stimulating wit and wisdom is insatiable. Wendy Doniger is the Mircea Eliade Distinguished Service Professor of the History of Religions at the University of Chicago. Her doctorates are from Harvard in Sanskrit and Oxford in Indian Studies. An influential teacher and beloved mentor of some people in this room, as well as a multiple prize-winning author, fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, that's Phi Beta Kappa for grown-ups, former president of the American Academy of Religion, holder of 4 honorary doctorates, and so forth, Professor Doniger combines her special interest and erudition in Hinduism with the study, broadly cross-disciplinary and cross-cultural, of myth. Inasmuch as at one time or another, her writing has lingered over virtually every important human concern, literature, law, gender, politics, theology, ecology, love, and horses, or make that love of horses, it's no surprise that Professor Doniger's corpus includes a book title, The Origins of Evil in Hindu Mythology, with specific pertinence to our Institute series. More generally, her scholarship has organized and understood vast amounts of mythological material in terms of the kind of real, basic, unpretentious questions about which, once she's asked them, we can all admit to being curious. I'm thinking, for example, of her book, The Bed Trick, for which she won a prize from the British Academy in 2002. And where, following on her title's allusion to the time-honored topos of a character's waking up in bed with the wrong person, she asks, why the themes of deception, masquerade, and mistaken identity in sexual relations are so prevalent across time and place, from the ancient Hindu myths to contemporary Hollywood cinema. Another recent title, Splitting the Difference, Gender and Myth in Ancient Greece and India, recalls to mind the likewise exemplary care she takes, giving both detail and the big picture their due, to articulate the play of differences between the universal and the local particular, both in bodies of myth and in mythical bodies. On that note, please join me in welcoming Professor Doniger, the woman who really is who she thought she was, and whose lecture for us today is entitled, When Humans Are More Beastly Than the Beasts, Zoomorphism in Ancient India. Professor Doniger.
Thank you for a wonderful introduction. As the dean pointed out, I have written a whole big book about evil faced head on, and today's lecture is not taking it on face on, but dealing with some moral issues that arise through the use of animal imagery. So the moral issues are implicit, and I'll bring them out where I can, but I'm really talking about the way that humans have imagined animals and animals have imagined humans. So human beings have two persistent habits in their imagination of animals, projecting human qualities upon animals, which we call anthropomorphism, and imagining humans as animals, which I want to call zoomorphism. Projecting human qualities upon animals tells us comparatively little about animals. An anthropomorphic text assumes a basic identification, such as lion as king. And then, although the object of discourse is theoretically an animal, the text imagines the animal as behaving the way the human does, betraying the fact that it is interested only in kings and not at all in lions. Imagining humans as animals is more complex. Although this time a human being is the explicit object, the bestial qualities imputed to the human usually reveal an observation of animals more detailed, if no more accurate, than that of projecting human qualities upon animals. And the text teaches us simultaneously what sort of person it thinks that animal is like, and what sort of animal it thinks that sort of person is like. We learn about our own assumptions by comparing ourselves with other creatures who do not share them, a process that has been compared to Sherlock Holmes's method, asking why the dog did not bark in the night, which depends upon your knowledge that dogs generally bark at strangers and not at friends. And where projecting human qualities upon animals simply leaps over our knowledge that most animals cannot speak, there are significantly relatively few anthropomorphic stories about parrots who do speak. Imagining humans as animals seizes upon language as a point of potential difference between humans and animals, and worries that point in various ways, imputing human speech to certain individual animals, and either mutinous or, on the other hand, the ability to understand animal languages to certain individual humans. So I'm using language as the dividing point here. The complex interrelationship between zoomorphism and anthropomorphism was illuminated by a bon mot spoken by the late Sidney Morgenbesser in accusing the behaviorist B.F. Skinner. And he said to Skinner, "Let me see if I understand your thesis. You think we shouldn't anthropomorphize people? Let us begin with a quick survey of the relatively straightforward text of projecting human qualities upon animals, and progress to the more challenging texts of imagining humans as animals." India is a particularly good place to look for such texts, as ancient Sanskrit literature, composed in India from about 1000 BC, really to the present, abounds in animal imagery. India is famous for its beast fables, in which animals stand for human types and point human morals. The lion as king, the cunning jackal as his chief minister, clever monkeys and foolish donkeys, the ongoing battle of the crows against the owls. The most famous collection of these stories is the Panchatantra, probably composed about 500 CE, but drawing upon much older Buddhist sources. The Panchatantra is a textbook of political science, probably intended for the education of princes. But its cast of characters was widely diffused into all levels of Indian literature, and ultimately we know it through Aesop's fables and La Fontaine. The heron, or the cat, for instance, is a widespread image of the religious hypocrite. A cat pretended to be a vegetarian ascetic and ate the mice until one day they discovered mouse bones in the cat's feces and figured it all out. The heron seems to be meditating until he gobbles up a fish. Animals also serve as metaphors more broadly in Indian culture. The dominant metaphor, indeed the cliché for anarchy, is the law of the fishes. The big fish eat the little fish. Indian mythology also used fish as a metaphor for an alternative consciousness. One such myth is an Indian parallel to a story more famous from the Taoist version, the story of the sages on the bridge, arguing about their ability to know if fish are happy. This is the story, the Taoist story, not the Indian story. How can you possibly know in what consists the pleasure of fishes? And you, not being I, retorted Chuangzi, how can you know that I do not know? If, that's what people usually say, but it goes on, and the second part is even better. If I, not being you, cannot know what you know, urged Tweetzer, it follows that you, not being a fish, cannot know in what consists the pleasures of fishes. Let us go back, said Chuangzi, to your original question. You asked me how I knew in what consists the pleasure of fishes. Your very question shows that you knew I knew. I knew it from my own feelings. I knew it from my own feelings on the How Bridge. And I've put that pun on the how and the how into English to equivalent, to make an equivalent to the Chinese pun on knowing from. How do you know? From what do you know? The answer, from my feelings on the bridge, suggests a metaphor. We know because of the emotion, my feelings, that connect us with the fish. But the bridge, the occasion for this other pun on how, is also a metaphor for all that separates us from the fish. We can never be certain that we know their happiness. The corresponding Indian tale in a Sanskrit text assumes that we can know about the happiness of fish, but that this very understanding leads to a problem. Not the problem of intellectual isolation, as in the Chinese parable, but on the contrary, the problem of human involvement. This is the Sanskrit story. There was once a sage who spent 12 years immersed in a pond. In that pond there lived a great fish who had many children and grandchildren. The young fish played around the great fish all day, and he lived happily among them. Their games began to disturb the sage's meditations. He noticed them and thought, how enviable is that fish always playing so happily? Everybody thinks fish are happy. Always playing so happily with his children. It makes me want to taste that pleasure too and to play happily with my own children. And so the sage got out of the water and went to the king to demand a bride. He married the king's 50 daughters and had 150 sons. But eventually he realized that his desires were self-perpetuating and hence insatiable, and that he must return to the meditations that the fish had disturbed. So he abandoned his children and his wives and returned to the forest. In this story, the Hindu sage is not depicted, like one of the Taoist sages, as mistaken in his empathy. The fish are happy, taking pleasure in the same things that humans take pleasure in, playing with their children. We might ask if the sage could have been made aware of the pleasures of child-rearing by a vision not of fish, but of humans and their children. But the text implies that the sage has left human company and hence would not see human children. Moreover, the sage understands the fish where he might not have understood his fellow men and women, because he's become, in effect, a kind of animal himself. Fish-like, he lives underwater in a transhuman condition made possible by his extraordinary ascetic powers. But the sage is mistaken in believing that he personally can be happy like a fish, or rather, that such happiness is desirable for him. He comes to learn that though other people may be like fish in enjoying their children, he himself is not like them in his special powers of meditation, and hence, though fish-like in being non-human, not like a fish in procreation. A more extensively developed anthropomorphism pervades the great Ramayana text, composed by Valmiki in Sanskrit in the 2nd century BC, extending on to the 2nd century CE. Like the Panchatantra, this text is ostensibly about a king, though it is a continuous epic narrative rather than a collection of moral lessons. And like the beast fables, the Ramayana was widely diffused throughout Indian culture, far beyond the world of kings. The central characters of the text, Rama, the perfect prince, Sita, his perfect wife, and Lakshman, his perfect brother, later to form the template for the perfect worshiper of the now deified Rama, these were born to be paradigms. Goody-goodies, or in the case of the perfectly demonic demon king Ravana, who steals Sita from Rama and keeps her captive on the island of Lanka for many years, a baddie-baddie. They are very extreme moral types. If that were all there was to the Ramayana, it would have proved ideologically useful to people interested in enforcing moral standards or in rallying religious fanatics, as alas it has proved all too capable of doing to this day in India. But it would probably not have survived as a beloved work of great literature, as it also has done. Rama sometimes is and sometimes is not depicted as God in the original Sanskrit text. Often he seems to forget that he is and has to be reminded of it, and more often it doesn't seem to be an issue at all. But even in Sanskrit, God is in the details, and the details of the Ramayana are what give its characters their character. More precisely, each of the major human characters has a double among the monkeys who help Rama kill Ravana and retrieve Sita. These doubles are, ironically, more flesh and blood, as we would say, more complex and nuanced than the human characters that they mirror, or rather, added to those original human characters, they provide the nuances of ambiguity and ambivalence that constitute the depth and substance of the total character, composed of the original human plus the monkey shadow. There are a number of parallels between monkeys and people in general in the Ramayana, both explicit and implicit. The appropriateness of these parallels is supported by such factors as the human character's assumption that though they cannot understand the language of the deer, Rama explicitly laments this fact when he runs off after a golden deer that he suspects, rightly, to be a demon in disguise. He says, "I wish I could talk to him." Yet humans do not comment on the fact that they can understand the language of the monkeys. Hanuman, the general in chief of the monkeys, not only speaks human languages, but speaks Sanskrit, which is really a hard language to speak. When he approaches Sita on the island of Lanka, he anxiously debates within himself precisely what language he will use to address her. He thinks to himself, "If I assume a human form and speak Sanskrit like a sage, Sita will think I am the demon Ravana, because Ravana keeps changing forms and appears often as a Sanskrit-speaking sage, and she'll be terrified. But I must speak with a human tongue, or else I cannot speak to her and encourage her. Yet she will think I am Ravana, who can take any form he wants, and she'll scream and we'll all be killed." He finally does address her in Sanskrit, and she is suitably impressed. She does not scream. Monkeys are like people and function as the shadows of people. In the human world, Rama's father has put Rama's younger brother on the throne in place of Rama, the eldest, and exiled Rama to the forest. Sita goes with him. In the forest, where humans understand the speech of monkeys, after the demon Ravana has stolen Sita, Rama meets a monkey who says that he used to be the king of monkeys until his brother stole his wife and his throne. Rama sides with this monkey and murders the monkey brother by shooting him in the back, an episode that troubles the South Asian tradition for centuries to this very day. Why does he do it? Apparently because Rama senses a parallel between his situation and that of the apparently deposed king, and therefore sides with the monkey king against his brother. But the usurping monkey brother does not actually parallel any single enemy of Rama. It was Rama's father who exiled Rama and caused him to flee to the forest. There is no enmity between Rama and his brother Bharata, though Bharata occupies Rama's throne, and it was Ravana who carried off Rama's consort. If the Monkey King is to be taken as the simian counterpart of Rama, then the usurping monkey brother is a combination of Rama's father, the demon Ravana, and Rama's brother, Bharata. This is hardly a neat parallelism. No, Rama sides with the wrong monkey. The apparently usurping monkey is, like Rama, the true heir, the older brother. The deposed Monkey King had originally taken the throne from his monkey usurping monkey brother. Yet the main implication of Hanuman's speech is true. Rama sympathizes with Sugriva because each of them has lost his wife and has a brother occupying the throne that was to be his. The situations are the same, but the villains are entirely different, and this is what Rama fails to notice. The monkey's access to human language also grants them access to human ethics, or dharma. On another occasion when Rama behaves badly, the monkeys remind him that he is a man, that is, higher than a monkey, just as he is elsewhere reminded when he behaves badly that he is a god, that is, higher than a man. When Rama kills the Monkey King's brother, hitting him in the back, the dying monkey reproaches Rama, saying, "I'm just a monkey living in the forest, a vegetarian, but you are a man. I'm a monkey, and it is against the law to eat monkey flesh or wear monkey skin." He quotes the Hindu Dharma text when he says that. That is, as a human, Rama should have a higher ethics than a monkey and should obey human laws against the mistreatment of monkeys. It may also be implied that monkeys in particular are protected by human dharma, perhaps because of their perceived proximity to humans. But Rama defends himself against the charge of foul play by taking the opposite lead. "What does it matter whether you were fighting me or not, since you are nothing but a monkey? And here is the crowning argument. Snares and hidden traps are always used to catch wild animals, and I don't think there's anything wrong about this. Even sages go hunting. That is why I struck you when you were fighting with your brother." Rama argues that monkeys, not being human, cannot invoke human dharma. But Rama is whistling in the dark here. The text and the tradition judge him to have violated human dharma in his treatment of the monkey. Raman is driven to this unethical act because the rage and resentment that he should feel toward his brother and father, but does not, because he is the perfect son and the perfect brother, is expressed for him by his monkey double, the deposed Monkey King, and vented by Rama on that double's enemy, his brother, who doubles for Rama's brother and father. This is the sense in which the monkeys are the shadows of the human brothers, or rather side shadows, to use Gary Saul Morrison's term. They suggest what might have been. The monkeys are not merely the author's projections, nor projections from Rama's mind. They are rather literary fractions, symbolic layers, parallel lives. The monkey story is not merely accidentally appended. It is a telling variant of the life of Rama, but it does not mirror that life exactly. It is a mythological transformation, taking the pieces and rearranging them to make a slightly different pattern, as we do in our dreams, according to Freud. Ernest Jones wrote about the ways in which animals often replace in dreams people toward whom the dreamer has strong, dangerous, inadmissible, and hence repressed emotions. Or to put it differently, the dreamer displaces emotions felt toward people whom he or she cannot bear to visualize directly in dreams and projects those emotions onto animals. Thus, Rama's cultural role as the perfect son and brother prevents him from expressing his personal resentment of his father and brother, and so the monkeys do it for him. In other versions of the Ramayana, such as the Tamil version by Kamban, Rama's brother Lakshman expresses the anger against their father that Rama cannot express himself. In the magical world of the monkey forest, Rama's unconscious mind is set free to take the revenge that his conscious mind does not allow him in the world of humans. Now I want to talk about zoomorphism. A liminal space between anthropomorphism and zoomorphism is marked out by a mythological cluster about talking animals and humans who commit the fatal error of mistaking sexual humans for animals. This corpus of myths is found in both of the great Sanskrit epics, the Ramayana, which we've just considered, and the Mahabharata, composed probably between the 3rd centuries BC and CE. These myths argue that we often mistake animals for people, and the reverse, in sexual or quasi-sexual situations. They also imply that people become animals, and therefore in a sense unrecognizable, in the sexual act that Shakespeare's Iago imagined as a beast with two backs. And finally, they imply that hunting animals is, like sex, a vice of lust. The ancient Indian textbook of political science lists hunting along with sex, gambling, and drinking under the vices of desire. And we've seen Rama defending himself against charges of foul play against an animal argue even sages go hunting. The ultimate result of this conflation is that human hunters often mistake other humans for animals, particularly when the animals are mating, a mistake that has fatal consequences not only for the animals, but for the unlucky hunter. At the beginning of the Mahabharata, a king is cursed to die in the embrace of his own wife because he killed a sage whom he mistook for a stag when the sage was mating with his wife. They had taken the form of a stag and a doe to do this because they were too embarrassed to do it as humans, they say. Elsewhere in the Mahabharata, another king who's been cursed to become a man-eating demon devours a sage who was making love to his wife still in human form, and the wife, furious because she had not finished, curses the king to die if he embraces his own wife. These mistakes are not limited to the sexual arena. Later in this text, a warrior kills a young calf by mistake, presuming it for a wild animal, and is cursed to fall in a crucial battle. And at the end of the whole story of the Mahabharata, the incarnate god Krishna dies when a hunter named Old Age mistakes him for an animal and shoots him in the foot, the only part of him that is mortal, like Achilles' heel. Returning to the Ramayana, Rama's father mistakes a boy for an elephant, kills the boy, and is cursed to lose his own son. That's why he exiles Rama. Later, when Ravana plans to capture Sita, he gets another demon to take the form of a marvelous golden deer that captivates Sita and inspires her to ask Rama to pursue it for her. Rama suspects that it is a demon in disguise. This is where he says he wishes he could talk to it. But Sita insists. The deer leads Rama far away from Sita, and when Rama kills the deer and it assumes its true demonic form, Rama realizes that he has been tricked and has thereby lost Sita, whom Ravana has captured in Rama's absence. Thus, once again, the killing of a human, or in this case, a demon, in animal form, causes the hunter to suffer the curse of separation from his sexual partner. The theme of language first enters this corpus on the outside frame of the Ramayana, where we learn that the author, the poet who composed the Ramayana, was searching for a poetic language in which to tell the story when he went to bathe in a river. There he saw a hunter kill the male of a pair of mating cranes. And when the hen grieved, the poet cried out, "Hunter, since you killed one of these birds at the height of its passion, you will not live very long." Then the poet realized that he had instinctively uttered this curse in verse, in a meter, the meter in which the epics are composed, called the shloka, because it was uttered in sorrow, shoka. With this link added to the narrative chain, the corpus of stories combines 5 major themes: succumbing to the lust for hunting, mistaking a human for an animal and killing the animal, interrupting the sexual act by killing one or both of the partners, understanding the language of animals, and creating a poetic language. Killing an animal interrupts the sexual act, the animal act, killing sex, as it were, and producing in its place the characteristic human act, the making of language. Another tale in the Ramayana also ties together the themes of the interruption of sexuality, the curse of separation from a beloved, the deadly nature of erotic love, and the language of birds. A king, who is the father of Rama's evil stepmother, had been given the boon of understanding the cries of all creatures, but he was warned that he must not tell anyone about it. Once when he was in bed with his wife, he heard a bird say something funny, and he laughed. She thought he was laughing at her, and she wanted to know why, but he said he would die if he told her. When she insisted that he tell her nevertheless, he sent her away and lived happily without her for the rest of his life. As an indirect result of his ability to comprehend the language of birds, this king hears a bird talking when he is in a sexual situation and laughs, which exposes him to the danger of death and separates him from his mate. This story is in many ways the inversion of the story of the poet, who sees a bird killed, hence separated from his mate, which makes him cry rather than laugh and inspires him to invent the unusual language of humans, the poetic language. This king Rama's step-grandfather is forced to become separated from his wife, just as Rama's father is cursed to be separated from his son. The two episodes are related. The stepmother, the daughter of the woman who wanted to know why the bird laughed, is the paradigmatic evil co-wife who uses sexual blackmail to force Rama's father to disinherit Rama, an act that is regarded as directly responsible for the father's death. So she does kill her husband, as her mother failed to do. Significantly, the man in this story is allowed to understand the speech of animals and the woman is not. This is in keeping with the underlying Hindu misogyny of the Sanskrit mythological texts that depict men as more gifted with special powers than women are. It may also reflect the actual sociological fact that men in India were allowed to read and speak Sanskrit, while in general, there were important exceptions, in general, women were not. In a broader sense, as we'll see, all hyper-sexualized women are represented as talking animals, but not as talking with animals. These stories express the idea that the possession of human speech is a prerogative that may deprive humans of their sexuality, but may deprive animals of their lives. Sexuality makes humans into animals. Language makes animals into humans. We've now seen one reason why in Hindu myths humans become animals, that is to partake of animal sexuality. But there are other reasons why humans and even gods become animals, and this takes us deeper into the realm of anthropomorphism. At the end of the Mahabharata, the great king Yudhishthira, the Dharma king, who is the son of the concept of Dharma incarnate as a god, justice, religious law, becomes incarnate and fathers this king. At the very end, Yudhishthira is walking on the path to heaven, followed by a dog who has joined up with him. Yudhishthira went on, never looking down, only the dog followed him. Then Indra, the king of the gods, came to Yudhishthira in his chariot and said, "Get in." Yudhishthira said, "This dog is devoted to me. Abandon the dog. Dogs are not allowed in heaven. You can't come to heaven unless you leave the dog behind." They go back and forth a long time. Yudhishthira says, "It's cruel to abandon anyone who's devoted to you, and I won't do it." And the king says, "Well, then you won't go to heaven." And Yudhishthira says, "I don't care. I'm not abandoning this dog." At that moment, the god, who had been there in the form of the dog, took his own form, Dharma. It was the god Dharma incarnate in the dog. And he spoke to Yudhishthira with affection and said, "Yudhishthira, you have been born well. You behave," he says, "you have your father's good looks and good disposition." He is, of course, Yudhishthira's father. "And now you gave up your chance to go to heaven because you said, 'This dog is devoted to me.' Because of this, you may enter heaven with your body." We'll talk about what that means. So the moral law, Dharma, absolutely forbids Hindus to have any contact with dogs who are regarded as unclean scavengers, the parasites of untouchables. What is most striking about this passage is that the god of Dharma himself becomes incarnate in this animal. It's as if the god of the Hebrew Bible became incarnate in a pig. It's incomprehensible. Clearly, animals, real animals, not animal symbols or anthropomorphic animals, are being used here to make a powerful ethical point. All good Hindus go to heaven, but they do so after dying and being given a different heavenly body. Yudhishthira is unique in being given the gift of going to heaven in his own body. There may well be an implication here that in acknowledging his bond with animals, treating his dog like someone who has come to him for refuge or a friend, Yudhishthira has somehow preserved the animality of his own body, that very animality denied by the sages who regard both dogs and sexuality as dirty, and enters heaven not merely as a disembodied spirit, but as his entire self. Humans are animals in a very different sense in the Kama Sutra, composed in North India probably at the very end of the epic period, the 3rd century CE. Here, humans are distinguished from animals precisely by their sexuality. In the argument that the author puts forward to justify the existence of his text, he says, why should anyone have written a book, the Kama Sutra, about human sexuality? And he gives, first of all, the argument of people he calls scholars, which means sort of pedantic, dried old fools. It's a word which nor acharya normally has a very honorable meaning in India, but in the Kama Sutra, it's a satire. So he says, scholars say you don't need to have a book about sex, since even animals manage sex by themselves, and since it goes all the time, so it shouldn't have to be handled with the help of a text. Then he gives his own answer. He says, because a man and a woman depend upon one another in sex, it requires a method, and this method is learned from the Kama Sutra. The mating of animals, by contrast, is not based upon any method, because they are not fenced in. They mate only when the females are in their fertile season and until they achieve their goal, and they act without thinking about it first. So all of these are implicitly not true of human beings. The commentary on this, written 1,000 years later, says, desire goes on all the time for animals. Who is the guru for deers and birds for the methodology to give and take pleasure with those whom they desire? The qualities of wanting and hating are always there in the soul. There's no guarding or any other form of concealment for animals because the females of the species are loose, not like us. Animals mate only during their fertile season. Humans who want children, however, do it during a woman's fertile season, but also outside her fertile season in order to enjoy and please the woman. So animals and humans are not the same. And so the law book says, you may have sex with a woman in her fertile season or any other time when it is not expressly forbidden. And animals, the commentary continues, engage in sex just until they finish. They do not wonder, has he finished or not, and therefore wish to mate a second time. And so, since the goal of animals and humans is not the same, animals need no method for sex. Animals, moreover, do not first think before engaging in sex, what will happen to religion, power, sons, relatives, and the prosperity of our faction? Sex just happens to animals in their own way. So the implicit contrast is that animal sexuality is different from human sexuality. Here again, human language is explicitly contrasted with animal sexuality. Humans, who are more complex, more repressed, fenced in, as the text puts it, require language, a textbook, where animals do not. Humans, therefore, have a different sexuality for animals and need a text. But when we move from the world of science to the world of metaphor within the same text, the Kama Sutra, it appears that some humans are very much like animals, precisely in their sexuality. Here we may recall the sages who had to take on animal form in order to mate. The text of the Kama Sutra offers a sexual typology according to size. It says the man is called a hare, bull, or stallion, and the woman is called a doe, a mare, or an elephant cow. What's wrong with this picture? The women's animals are always much bigger than the male's animals. So you get an elephant woman mating with a stallion, a mare mating with a bull, and a female deer mating with a little rabbit, a hare. Clearly, the 6 paradigmatic animals are chosen for their size rather than their cultural symbolism, but the disparity in their sizes reveals their deeper symbolic implication for the relationship between men and women. The nomenclature as a whole also implies that despite the text's insistence that the sexuality of animals is different from that of humans, there is a very basic sense in which sex, even when done according to the book, as it were, is bestial. Later in the Kama Sutra, the greater animality of women is assumed in a passage that makes them, in contrast with men, creatures both explicitly likened to animals and said to speak a meaningless animal language. It's in the section about striking women. There are eight kinds of screaming: whimpering, groaning, babbling, crying, panting, shrieking, or sobbing. And there are various sounds that have meaning, such as mother, stop, let go, enough. As a major part of moaning, she may use, according to her imagination, the cries of the dove, cuckoo, green pigeon, parrot, bee, nightingale, goose, duck, and partridge. He strikes her on her back with his fist when she is seated on his lap. Then she pretends to be unable to bear it and beats him in return while groaning, crying, or babbling. Shrieking is a sound like a bamboo splitting, and sobbing sounds like a berry falling into water. Always, if a man tries to force his kisses and so forth on her, she moans and does the very same thing back to him. When a man in the throes of passion slaps a woman repeatedly, she uses words like stop, or let me go, or enough, or mother, and utters screams mixed with labored breathing, panting, crying, and groaning. These are the ways of groaning and slapping. It's worth noting that these women make the noises of birds, never of mammals, let alone the mammals that characterize the three paradigmatic sizes of women: elephants, horses, and deer. Birds, as we've seen, are implicated in the Hindu mythology of fatal sexuality linked with language. Moreover, one of the birds whose babbling the sexual woman imitates, the parrot, appears elsewhere in the Kama Sutra as one of the two birds who can be taught to speak like humans. Teaching parrots and minor birds to talk is a skill that both a man and a woman should learn. Courtesans in particular often have parrots in Indian poetry and paintings, and a skill that a man can use to lure a woman to his home, the ancient Indian equivalent of coming up to see his etchings. The passage about slapping and groaning inculcates what we now recognize as the rape mentality. Her mouth says no, but her eyes say yes. A dangerous line of thought that leads ultimately to places where we no longer want to be, disregarding a woman's protests against rape. And this treatment of women is justified by a combination of the official naming of women after oversized animals with oversized desire, and the expectation that in the throes of passion, women will become animals and lose their human speech. The behavior of the woman making her animal noises is a ritualized, performed action regarded as appropriate for her gender. At this point, the text tells us that men too may do this, but again, only in performance and only for a moment. It says, their passion and a particular technique may sometimes lead them even to exchange roles, but not for very long. In the end, the natural roles are reestablished. And the commentator explains, sometimes, but not always, there's an exchange out of the pull of passion. Then the woman abandons her own ways and changes to what the man has a natural talent for, doing the slapping, while the man abandons his own way of slapping the woman and takes up her ways, moaning and screaming. But after a short time, they change back. And in the absence of passion or this particular technique, they do it just as before, and there is no occasion to switch. In the Ramayana, as we've seen, the fact that Hanuman can speak Sanskrit and that monkeys in general can speak human languages challenges humans to apply human ethical considerations to monkeys alone among animals. The natural zoomorphism of women is the other side of the coin of this liminal anthropomorphism of the epics, in which some animals speak human languages and some humans, males in contrast with females, are privileged to understand the language of animals. In the full spate of sexuality, women lose their human language and become like animals. To compare this scenario with the paradigm of the death of copulating animals, We might say that in an inversion of the myth of the creation of poetic language by the violent interruption of sex, violent sex implies the suspension of language. Men, the texts tell us, may sometimes become like women who have become like animals, moaning and screaming instead of using male human speech. But a modern feminist would say that it is not at such moments of role reversal, but when men expect women to behave like animals while they themselves behave like men, that the men are truly behaving like animals. I want to conclude with a discussion of language and compassion for animals. Language is the place from which compassion springs. We now know that dolphins and whales can talk not only to one another, but to us. This knowledge brings to life the myth of the fish and the bridge and makes us wonder if perhaps someday dolphins will tell us their myths. But since dolphins are not fish but look like fish, and since they're animals but they talk to us as other animals cannot, they doubly straddle the boundary between our own categories of mammals and fish and thereby threaten our definition of what it is to be human. This accounts in part for some people's reluctance to call what the dolphins do speech. And in fact, the language that people use to talk to dolphins is neither the language in which dolphins talk to one another, nor the language in which we talk to one another. It is a kind of Rosetta Stone language. Yet it is a language, and it joins us with the fish. The belief that all animals may be in some sense less other than they seem to be is the source of the ever-enchanting myth of a magic time or place or person that erases the boundary between humans and animals. The time of this animal paradise finds a close parallel in the myth that tells of the time when gods walked among people or people walked among the gods. The place, like the magic place in the Looking Glass Forest, where things have no names. I always think of that as the Alzheimer's Forest, right? What is the, let's go under the, you know, that thing over there. It's a place where Alice could walk with her arms around the neck of a fawn. And it's like the high mountains where people mingle with the gods. And the particular individual with these special powers finds a parallel in the myth of a particular person, often a shaman or a priest, who has the special ability to traffic with the gods. Famous examples of such people who live at peace among animals would include Enkidu in the Epic of Gilgamesh, Francis of Assisi, and the many mythical children who are raised as cubs by a pack of animals like Romulus and Remus, Mowgli and Tarzan, like Pecos Bill suckled by a puma, and Davy Crockett raised among mountain lions. Our list might also include the women of Euripides' Bacchae, who suckle at their breasts fawns or wolf cubs while snakes lick their cheeks. I think it's significant that the Bacchae abandon their own nursing children and dismember tame cattle. It is only in the wild that they are at home. T.H. White, who once translated a medieval bestiary, imagined the young King Arthur's education by Merlin the magician as taking place among ants and geese and owls and badgers, whose language Arthur understood. Siegfried in German mythology and Fionn in Irish mythology gained the ability to understand the language of animals by licking their fingers after touching a part of a magic animal. For Siegfried, the blood of a dragon. For Fionn, the drippings from a magic salmon. Significantly, they do not actually eat the animals, though the animals are killed. The myths in which we speak the language of animals are generally myths about friendship with the wild animals that we normally hunt, not the tame animals that we sacrifice. But it might be extended to include children born and raised among domestic animals, Oedipus raised among sheep, and Jesus born in a manger. In the parallels to the stories in which we commune with gods rather than animals, the gods do not become human. A human becomes one of the gods. So too, the ideal state of humans among animals is not one in which wild animals become tame, as they often do in reality, after all, as in the story of Elsa the lioness and Born Free. It's a state in which a human becomes one of the animals. Nietzsche's Zarathustra encountered a sage in the forest who urged him, Do not go to man. Stay in the forest. Go rather even to the animals. Why do you not want to be as I am, a bear among bears, a bird among birds? But the human who becomes part of the society of the animals usually remains a human. The adopted child must eventually return to the human world. Zarathustra mocked and rejected Nietzsche's saint. To be a bird among birds means, among other things, not eating birds. It is difficult, though not impossible, to torment or eat the people we speak with. Elaine Scarry made the first point in reverse when she argued that torture takes away speech. And Lewis Carroll made the second point when the Red Queen, having introduced Alice to the roast, Alice Mutton, Mutton Alice, commanded, "It isn't etiquette to cut anyone you've been introduced to. Remove the joint." This compassion-inducing language need not be even the signing of chimps, let alone the whistles of dolphins or the body language of primates. It may be no more than the silent language of the eyes. Emmanuel Levinas once said that the face of the other says, "Don't kill me." This is the language that inspires empathy, the language that is denied by people who insist on treating animals as things. Anthropomorphism and zoomorphism are two different attempts to reduce the otherness between humans and animals, to see the sameness beneath the difference. The ethical decision to treat animals according to the basic standards of human decency is one that must be taken regardless of whether we prefer to emphasize the qualities that they share with us, such as aspects of their sexuality, or those that most of them do not, their language. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture by Professor Wendy Doniger entitled "When Humans Are More Beastly Than the Beasts: Zoomorphism in Ancient India." This lecture was part of a series of lectures looking at the topic of evil, presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. We began with an introduction by Susan Jackson, Associate Professor of French and Senior Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.